House Education Committee will come to order.
What did I just say?
Education.
Energy.
Everybody's an educational problem. Welcome to my
age. Start with an E.
Welcome to my age.
There you go. Okay. Energy Committee will come to order. About 3:13 on Thursday the 23rd. It is the 38th day of the legislative session. Means we're not even halfway through.
Yes.
Oh, fun. We're in the Ramona Barnes Committee Room, which is room 124. Present today, we have Representative Lynn, Representative Sadler, Representative Foster, the co-chair, and myself, Representative Pruitt. We should be joined here shortly by, I believe, Representative Munoz and a few others that actually are not on the committee, and we do have a few excuse, at least one excused with Representative Olson. And then I understand there's a couple of the members that might have to step away for a few minutes with a function going on with Senator Murkowski, but we'll go ahead and take the testimony. For everyone that is here for testimony or online for testimony, we will not only be hearing it here, and of course we thank Representative Munoz for helping facilitate some of this conversation, help us understand what's going on in Southeast here, but we'll also make sure that the testimony, that if you have it, we'll pass it on to AEA, or we'll make sure that you have the ability to get it to them. So on that note, also cell phones, if you have them, please make sure that they don't go off. We don't want them to disrupt the recording. We will continue today with the discussion on the independent integrated resource plan related to here down here to Southeast. You guys are kind of the guinea pig down here as we see what is being formulated before any others are put into place. We're going to try to go through all the public testimony. We do have some people online. The intent is to keep it to 3 minutes. If we can't, but it doesn't look like we're going to need to keep a timer here. Probably don't have enough people here or online that will have to do that. But we would ask that you respect the time frame and other people's give them opportunity to have that discussion. And feel free, gentlemen. To step aside for that. Expect to see them back here. We will start first with Jeremy Maxand. He is online. He is from Wrangell and the Southeast Alaska Power Agency. Mr. Maxand, are you there?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the draft integrated resource plan for Southeast Alaska. My name is Jeremy Maxand. I'm the mayor of the city and borough of Wrangell and currently serve as the board member of the Southeast Alaska Power Agency, formerly known as the Four Dam Pool. SEPA is a joint action agency providing power to Wrangell, Petersburg, and Ketchikan. We operate the Swan Lake and Tyee Lake hydro projects and more than 170 miles of transmission lines. I am submitting these comments today on behalf of the SEPA Board of Directors. SEPA is currently reviewing the entire document and will be providing written comments to AEA by the filing deadline in March. We recognize that this Southeast IRP is a high-level directional document and does not, nor should it, provide specific solutions. We also recognize that significant and detailed engineering, economic, and other analyses will be needed to identify these solutions. SEPA qualitatively agrees with some of the results and observations identified in the IRP draft report specific to the SEPA region. We recognize that we have a hydro storage capacity shortage. SEPA is currently evaluating options to increase our storage capacity as well as other new energy resources. We are certainly planning for economic growth. We also recognize that the recent increase in the cost of heating oil has resulted in significant conversions from oil space heating to electric space heating. We felt that on our system. The report recommends the aggressive pursuit of demand-side management and energy efficiency as well as biomass conversion programs, and also recommends that these programs be developed on a regional basis with close coordination with utilities. We see this as a very significant effort and will require years, if not decades, to implement. Due to the high-level nature of this IRP study, the public is not yet fully aware a problem exists. The state will need to take a leadership role if this regional effort is to be successful. The local communities and utilities simply do not have the resources to successfully implement this program on their own. I think it's important to note that demand-side management and energy efficiency are, if done correctly, the cheapest and fastest way to gain net power and to bring on and preserve hydro while we bring on new hydro to our system. So I do think we recognize the importance of those programs. We expect AEA and the contractor to engage the communities to explain their report findings, and we trust that is AEA's current intent. Again, the public must be involved in the process if they are to be part of the solution. We look forward to submitting detailed comments in the near future. And again, I want to thank Mr. Chairman and the committee members for the opportunity to briefly comment this afternoon. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for that. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Maxen. We're going to move next to Sitka and Larry Edwards. Are you there, Larry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry Edwards. I'm a longtime Sitka resident speaking for Greenpeace. This is an update to written comments I sent following your February 8th meeting. The draft IRP proposes converting 80% of the region's space heating to biomass in 10 years. The cost, $500 million. While calling for this massive biomass program, the plan dismissed heat pumps and related technologies from any notable role based on what are multiple instances of misinformation. For example, the claim that air source heat pumps generally require expensive ducts is outdated information and no longer true. There are now inexpensive split and mini split models, easy to install, and already hard at work here in Southeast. The IRP totally ignored the increasing use of heat pumps in Southeast hydro communities. Here in Sitka, the Forest Service Office has had air source heat pumps for around 25 years, and Blacksley Middle School is converting to them right now. There are a number of other installations, including homes. Juneau has good examples, too, including geothermal and seawater source heat pumps at the airport and the NOAA lab. So the IRP is not credible on this topic at all. A very significant error in the IRP's claim of a 6.5 cent per kilowatt hour break-even point in energy costs for wood pellets versus heat pumps if wood pellets are at $250 a ton. You'll find that in Volume 2 in Table 16-9. 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour is around half the current cost of hydropower in the region's cities. That break-even point is grossly in error. Black and Veatch acknowledged to me last Sunday, after weeks of delay, that the break-even at that pellet price is actually 19.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Further, at the current price of pellets, which the IRP says is $375 a ton, pellets don't break even with heat pumps until the cost of power reaches 29 cents a kilowatt hour. And the price of hydro in the communities that have it here is between 9 and 12 cents a kilowatt hour. At either price for pellets, pellet stoves will be far more costly than heat pumps for the foreseeable future and likely beyond. The IRP missed this point entirely, and an error assumed and acted on the opposite conclusion. The IRP gushes over the low cost of biomass versus fuel oil heat, and misses the fact that heat pumps greatly outperform biomass for low cost. The Alaska Energy Authority overlooks that fact, too. Tuesday, AEA's biomass program manager, Devany Pletnevich, testified to the House Economic Development Committee that wood pellet heat is much cheaper than oil heat, but she failed to disclose that in the hydro communities, heat pumps are far cheaper to run than pellet stoves. Appended to the one-page written comments I submitted to your committee on February 9 is a chart exposing the significance of the IRP's error about the break-even point and a simple spreadsheet of the calculations behind the chart. My numbers are very close but slightly higher than Black and Veatch's corrected numbers that I just mentioned. So my chart is now closely validated. These gross errors in the IRP, which result in the least cost heat pump option being summarily dismissed from consideration, should be declared fatal. They necessitate preparing a thoroughly revised draft of the Southeast IRP. This plan is not ready to go to a final version, The public needs to be able to comment on a reasonable, complete, and fair draft. The final point is that the hydropower communities can be converted from both the existing electric resistance and fuel oil heating to heat pumps with very little burden or even a gain for existing hydro systems. What we need is a 10-year program for conversion to heat pumps and related technologies, not a 10-year program for biomass. For example, in Sitka, in 2008, already 38% of residential heat was, according to the city's load forecast, electric resistance heat, and of course it's more than that by now. Converting these homes to heat pumps would cut power consumption enough to also move all fuel oil users to switch to heat pumps, with a net reduction of the city's power consumption. Also, efficient seawater source heat pumps incorporated into district heating systems, as demonstrated for decades in Scandinavia, would save even more power capacity. Their recent technology has even made it economical to provide district heat into low-density residential areas. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Edward. I would like to note that Representative Peterson joined us here momentarily, or just a few minutes ago. Mr. Edwards, one question that I have for you is one of the things that resource plan here indicates is that as more people move to heating their homes with electricity or heat pumps or whatever that may be, that there's a drain on the hydro sources and potentially the need to use diesel to generate. How does that influence the numbers that you were stating that compares the biomass to the heat pump numbers?
Yeah, I think I understand your question. The difficulty is that people are converting to electric resistance heat. But if instead they use electrically driven heat pumps, those are three times more efficient than resistance heat is. So if you can convert people from resistance heat that are already using resistance heat to heat pumps, that frees up a lot of energy. And in fact, you know, using the example for Sitka that I just gave, there are enough people on resistance heat already that you can take up that freed up hydro capacity, get everybody that's using fuel oil off of fuel oil onto heat pumps, and you can save 16,000 megawatt hours a year of what's presently being consumed.
Okay. And is your, you mentioned if we moved people away from it into from resistance to heat pump, I mean, if someone's just recently invested in the heat resistance, it might not make sense for them at this point to turn around and spend additional money. Do you have any suggestions on that? Should the state have an investment in that? Is that one of the things that you may be indicating?
Well, in the IRP where it's talking about the biomass conversion, they're talking about incentives to make that happen. In fact, they're talking about paying for the entire capital cost. It's a $500 million plus program. And with that kind of money, you could do the same thing with heat pumps and be a lot farther ahead in the long run. And in fact, if you look at it, you know, if people go to biomass, they're still going to be buying fuel on a continual basis on the market, and the market's going to fluctuate, and the market's going to be determined in large part by the competing energy sources, such as pellets from the lower 48, if we have pellet manufacturing here, or fuel oil. And it's going to be a supply and demand market, and those producing pellets are going to try to maximize their profits. But if people are on heat pumps, you can project far ahead what your electric prices are going to be. They're going to be lower, as I indicated, than pellets anyway. But it's more of a stable situation where you can look ahead and you know what you've got, and you know it's low cost and stable compared to pellets. So I think it's very beneficial to the regional economy as a whole.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Edwards. Is there any other questions?
And I should also say my apologies to not addressing the communities, the problems in the rural communities. I understand their problems, but my testimony is specific to the larger communities that are on the big hydro projects. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Edwards. Any questions from committee? Mm-hmm. We'll indicate that Representative Munoz has joined us. Thank you for being here. We will move, we'll kind of bounce back and forth between people online and people in here. I'd like to give people here an opportunity as well. Let's go with Mike. Are you here? Yeah, I saw you here. I'll let you just introduce yourself. You know,
thank you.
Most of us know who you are, but go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Pruitt and members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify on the SEIRP. My name is Michael Satry. I'm a resident of Juneau, Alaska, and I'm employed as the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers, and I'm speaking on their behalf today. The Council of Alaska Producers is a nonprofit trade association representing the producing large metal mines and developmental projects in the state of Alaska. Three of our members operate and explore in southeast Alaska and have a keen interest in the energy development plans for our region. These members are the Core Alaska Kensington Gold Mine, the Hecla Greens Creek Mine, and Heatherdale Resources, the developer of the Niblack Project. Mining and milling are energy-intensive processes, and in remote mine locations, that power is typically produced by diesel generators. This is an increasingly costly process subject to strict environmental regulations. The Core Alaska Kensington Gold Mine and the Niblack Project currently generate their own power, and the Hecla Greens Creek Mine was originally opened and operated on diesel as well. However, in 2006, the Greens Creek Mine, through a public-private partnership, was connected via intertie with the Juneau area grid serviced by AELMP. While Greens Creek is an interruptible customer, it receives significant economic benefit when it is on hydropower, which extends the mine life and the jobs it provides in the region. Having this large industrial customer connected to the grid also allowed the acceleration of the construction of the Dorothy Lake project and has resulted in lower increases to the rates charged to Juneau customers. Unfortunately, the draft SEIRP does not seem to adequately address either existing or potential future loads that mining may create. The SEIRP does not seem to recognize that since Greens Creek was connected to the grid, its demand for electricity has outstripped AELMP's ability to provide it on a regular basis. The SEIRP also does not seem to recognize the potential for provision of power to Kensington to accelerate the development of generation and or transmission projects. We do agree that trying to quantify the amount and timing of the future demands of projects like Niblack or even Bokan Mountain is speculative. However, the draft does not seem to recognize that mining development could be leveraged to develop generation and transmission resources that could benefit the entire region. We understand that any plan of this magnitude will never satisfy all stakeholders. The SEIRP does do a great job of attempting to quantify and analyze the myriad challenges facing anyone attempting to develop renewable energy resources in the region. In fact, there are many good things in this plan, including the highlighting of the critical lack of storage capacity in the region and the focus on demand-side management as a short-term solution to dealing with our energy shortage. Unfortunately, this draft plan, in the short term, seems to ignore the potential for mining on both sides of the border to act as a partner in the development of energy resources throughout the region. We would ask that in your review of this plan, this committee and the rest of the legislature provide direction to the AEA to show them that mining and other large industrial users are appropriately accounted for in short and long-term recommendations. Thank you for the opportunity to come for you.
Thank you. Any questions from committee? You mind if I ask you, Mike, real quick? You stated it, but I want to make sure you're clear. Do we put too much of a focus, and I don't want to see too much of a focus, but is the focus mostly on residential, and do we seem to, in this plan, keep out most of the discussion on industrial development and the potential that it could bring to supplying some of those residential needs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, we are still working through the plan to provide true technical comments as we work through this process, and we look forward to working with the AEA project manager on this. Yes, there's a huge focus on residential issues, and I think the focus is there because they're trying to address the shift of electrical demand from industrial users into residential users primarily because of heat, and there's a multitude of solutions that could be addressed there. I think ultimately the goal from the council's perspective is to look at mining or any other large industrial user that could consume lots of energy. Look at them as potentially an anchor tenant in a mall. We're going to come in and we're going to develop our infrastructure. And we're going to try to permit and operate our mines in order to as quickly as possible in order to recoup the capital that we would put into it. But once we're there, we can act as that anchor tenant for extending infrastructure throughout the region, and we could leverage that demand to provide cheap, affordable power to the small villages that you couldn't justify that on their own, you know, on the little pieces around the region. So let's find ways, whether it's mining, timber, seafood processing, let's leverage those industrial uses to benefit the region.
Appreciate that. That's one of the things that when I was in Iceland last year that I noticed they did very well. So they used the industry to provide, you know, as an anchor tenant, to provide for the residential needs. I think that's one thing that we need to make sure we focus on as a state, whether it's just in this plan or elsewhere. So I appreciate that, Mike.
Thank you, Chair Brewer.
Yeah, thank you. We're going to move now to Bill Corbus. You're speaking for yourself. Please introduce yourself and for the record. And if you are with someone, please let us know. Otherwise, go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Bill Corbus. I am a former manager of Alaska Electric Light and Power Company, the local utility. I'm now retired. I also did a tour of as a commissioner of revenue for 4 years. So I think I understand the electrical situation. I can also look at it from the state's point of view. I followed the IRP process and was a member of the board of advisors of this of the IRP organization. I'm basically supportive of the draft Southeast IRP. I believe that the state has limited financial resources in the long run, and that the IRP is in the best long-term interests of Southeast electrical users and uses the state's financial resources that will be devoted to electrical matters in a prudent manner. In my mind, this directional document does four important things. It eliminates the concept of linking all Southeast Alaska with electrical interconnections. It addresses the problem of converting homes and businesses to electric heat, which we are currently experiencing. It suggests on the basis of a market analysis that the AKBC transmission link should be placed on hold and re-examined later to see if the economics have changed. And finally, it does not make specific provisions to provide electricity for the proposed mines. As far as the Southeast Intertie goes, I think Table 12.5 pretty well summarizes it. We're looking at $1 billion in 2011 dollars to provide an intertie system for Southeast Alaska, and I submit the state simply cannot afford that. And the analysis looks at transmission intertie from two perspectives, two economic perspectives, and it fails to satisfy either test. So I am satisfied with the proposed elimination of that concept, which has been around for a long time. As far as electric heat goes, we have a problem here that people are converting to electric heat at a very high rate, and if something isn't done, we're going to be running out of electricity, including AELP that just got through building Lake Dorothy. If we have to build new hydroelectric projects, they're going to be expensive, and rates will go up significantly. I believe that the demand-side proposal and, most importantly, the program to convert to the pellet heating technology is a good answer, and I support the state of a state of Alaska administered plan to implement both the demand-side manager measures as well as the pellet heating program. I believe that the AKBC intertie should be looked at the next time that the IRP is updated, and maybe the market conditions will have changed. And finally, as far as mining loads go, it takes, in my mind, it takes a long time to develop a mine. And I only point to you, the Kensington mine took about 20 years. Once mines are up and running, they're not necessarily going to keep running. And so I think that we need to follow each mine carefully and see how it's doing, not just that it makes a big announcement that it's now open for business. I think that it would be appropriate to look at maybe helping out a mine after it's been up and running. And if it can be shown that the mine is paying rates that are the cost that it, are involved in providing that service to the mine, I don't think that we should be providing the mine subsidized energy. And that in no way should other customers in an electrical system be required to subsidize the cost of providing service to mining loads. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Question from
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate you being here today. Have you been in discussions with the developers of Kensington or the operators of Kensington on the potential to someday tie into that operation? And is that feasible? And could that enable an expansion? I know we've in the past heard of expansion plans for the second phase of Lake Dorothy. I'm just wondering if you could comment on that and the practicality of it. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm not the manager of AELP as a starter. I am aware that that there have been discussions, and there has been a transition, several transitions in the Kensington mine management, which has made discussions difficult. But my observation that there are at least two hydro projects, small hydro projects, in the area near the Kensington mine that might be developed. It may not solve all of the Kensington's problems, but it would cut down considerably, very considerably, on the amount of fuel consumption, and would avoid the cost of building a extending the transmission line, which will be expensive and undoubtedly experience great permitting issues. And that might be the least expensive way to go, rather than building phase two of Lake Dorothy and a transmission intertie.
Would you like to follow up?
Thank you. With the phase two, at what point does that project become feasible? I mean, what are we assuming, that the population would grow to a certain level before it would be feasible, or can you look at large industrial customers in the way that you did with Greens Creek to justify that second phase, or would we even need to go to a second phase in order to make that connection a reality?
When we're going to build Lake Dorothy is very difficult to predict. My hope is it's a long, long ways out the road. It's been quite an arduous process to build phase one. I think that that there are other nearby hydro projects that should be explored very thoroughly before we talk about building the Lake Dorothy, which probably would, if we were to build Lake Dorothy, would probably result in increased rates for our other customers also, and if it was just to serve the Kensington mine.
Mr. Corbis, would you, as someone who was involved with the IRP process, what role did you guys put on industry and in developing the plan, and what did you guys see as the industry being there? Like, what industries? We've talked a little bit about mining. Did you take into account any of the others, and what role did you feel they played in developing this plan?
I do not believe that there was a member of the mining industry on the advisory board, but there were members of the mining industry that attended many of the meetings and did make comments as the process went on.
Okay. So the board and the developing the plan, the advisory board, they did not necessarily take the industry or different anchor tenants, for lack of a better term, and build something based off of what either is there, could be there. Instead, was the focus, did it start with the residential and then kind of grew from there?
I'd say that the thrust of it was to looking out for the interests of existing customers. It was not, I guess I would say it would be considered to be speculative to be taking all the into considerations that a mine may be built so many years down the road. We didn't do that. It's recognized that this plan would, say, be updated in 5 years. It'll take 5 years, in my opinion, before we know whether we're going to have, for instance, a mine on south of on Prince of Wales Island.
Okay.
I have a follow-up to that.
A follow-up.
Thank you. Was the Kensington load considered in the plan?
It was discussed.
It was. So the mining load was part of the consideration. I mean, you considered the actual mining need, or it's not the mining needs, the energy needs of that operation. Okay.
Okay. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so during these deliberations, was there any talk of a possible public-private partnership with some of the gold mines and working together to provide power that would be available to all users, with them being, quote, an anchor tenant?
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the plan, or are we talking about AELP? I'm sorry.
When you were building the plan during those sessions when people were meeting with stakeholders, was there a discussion about some sort of public-private partnership where maybe a gold mine operation would contribute to the building of transmission lines therefore maybe reduce the overall price of the project enough to where it could become economically feasible?
I don't recall that specifically coming up. I would say that that took care of itself in the case of AELP in Greens Creek without the help of the Alaska Energy Authority. I think that there is that opportunity with the Kensington mine. There are several projects, as I mentioned before, one of which is a potential AELP project. Another one is owned by an independent power producer, or the rights to it.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Corbis. We'll move to Jody Mitchell. She'll be here. Ms. Mitchell, please, if you would, state your name as well as your affiliation for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
I promise to tell the truth. No. I'm Jody Mitchell, and I am the CEO and general manager of Inside Passage Electric Cooperative. And we are a small, member-owned utility that serves the communities of Angoon, Hoona, Cake, Plukwan, and the Chilkat Valley. We have about 1,300 customers. From a rural perspective, I believe the plan provides a map and plan for the future. IPEC has an energy plan that we wrote in 2009 that we've been working off to wean ourselves off of diesel. Right now, our rates are in the 64-cent range per kilowatt hour for residential customers. Rates were in the high 20s. I believe they were 28 and a half cents or so when I first started working at IPEC back in 1993, when fuel prices were around 79, 80 cents a gallon. But, of course, with the rise in fuel prices, now well over $4 per gallon, even wholesale delivered to our fuel tanks in the village, our rates have obviously climbed really high. The people in the village are really having a hard time with not only electricity but with heating costs. I don't know how many of them heat with oil. I've never, explored that, but my guess is a lot of them are already heating with wood, and they have for probably forever. I doubt that with the incomes that they have that they're able to afford to heat with oil, much less electricity. I just want to say make a couple comments about the PCE program. The power cost equalization helps a lot for residential customers, but only about 30% of our sales are eligible for the PCE subsidy. That means 70%, which includes businesses, schools, churches, are all subject to the full rate. And I can't even imagine, or I don't know if you can imagine, what it's like to try to run a business with that kind of an electric rate. I don't know how they do it. And in fact, we've seen businesses closing, and it's just, you just feel really bad when that happens, especially when, young people are trying to make a living in the village, and their businesses just can't make it. Heating with electricity has hurt IPEC's plans for the future. We've been working with SEPA to work out a power sales agreement to buy power from them for the benefit of CAKE through the CAKE-Petersburg Intertie. But now that everyone's converted to electric heat, it wasn't even a year after they cut the ribbons on the new intertie between Swan and Tyee that we were told there was no power for CAKE. And, that was really crushing for us and our plans. We do have a plan B, so to speak, in that the Metlakatla intertie, we believe, will be able to provide us power indirectly, of course, through the SEPA network. And SEPA has been working with us, and they've been, sympathetic to our position. And But the reality is if we have to wait for another project to get done, it's going to be, many years, maybe 10, 15 years before another project comes online where they will have power for us. So I guess, I'm just saying that I agree with the IRP and the fact that, using heat or using electricity for heating is just really consumes so much power, and it's indirectly it's hurt my villages. And then the other thing the IRP talks about is the fact that the interties are not economic. And I believe that to be true. We chased the Hoona intertie for, most of 10 years. And as we were doing so, we watched the price of that intertie skyrocket from $25 million to $44 million. And in the IRP, I'm not questioning the price, but now it says $101.7 million. Even at $44 million, it just became just not economic for a small load like Hoona. And that was really that was a hard dream to let go of after spending all that time trying to get that intertie as a solution for Hoona. You could spend a lot of money on an intertie, and you have so many risks involved. What if the cable fails, which it will eventually? And then you're back to right where you started from. And you, then if you want to replace that cable, who knows how much it's going to cost then. So, you know, I totally agree with, you know, I know that a lot of people were surprised by that part of the IRP, that those theater tie system as it was dreamed. I remember the first time I ever looked at it, I thought, wow, what a great idea. This is awesome. I can't wait till that happens. And now I realize that that's just not going to happen. And I think a lot of people were struck by that. It was a lesson that I learned several years ago, however. You know, I'm happy with the plan from IPEC's perspective. There are three committed projects in the IRP that will benefit IPEC's ratepayers, and that's the Gardena Falls project for HUNA. Again, I just want to go back a step and say, you know, Gardena Falls was our plan B for HUNA. The reason we chased the intertie was because it would provide 100% of our power, and the Gardena Falls project will only displace 35% to 40% of the diesel generated power for HUNA. There's another project that we're looking at, but even with the two combined, it won't provide 100% of the needs for HUNA. So we're still going to have a diesel factor, and you know, whenever you have diesel, even as backup, you have all the costs associated with that. And when you have to run them, then, you know, you're I don't know how much savings we'll realize yet, but certainly better than being 100% diesel. Anyway, back to my the three committed projects. We have the Gardena Falls project for HUNA, the Cake-Petersburg intertie for Cake, which, again, as I said, Metlakatla is going to tie in also, so we do believe we'll have a power supply. And then the Thayer project, which is Kutsumu's project, is also in there as a committed project. And then another project that we were happy to have on the list, in the refined screen list, is the Walker Lake project for the Upper Chilkat Valley. So from our perspective at IPEC, the plan provides an opportunity for the region to join hands and work towards real solutions that will decrease energy costs for all of us. You know, there really is, as the plan says or mentions, they don't say it the way I say it, but there are haves and have-nots in Southeast, and IPEC communities are the have-nots. There has been hundreds of millions of state and federal funded grants that have gone to provide the low-cost infrastructure for the haves. And, you know, the IRP at least gives us hope that we might be able to enjoy some of the benefits of grant-funded plant as well and have lower-cost power, not just lower-cost, but renewable energy for our communities. And I will write some comments to deliver to AEA on the IRP, but those are my verbal comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned 64 cents that's the average for your communities. Is that correct?
That's for the residential customers. That's before PCE.
Before PCE. Okay, that was my question. Thank you.
Can I ask you quickly, the Kutsunuts project,
mm-hmm.
I believe there's a fifth phase of the renewable energy grant money that's going to it, but the fourth phase money has not been accepted or used. Can you give me a little bit of detail of where we're coming? Because this is obviously a part of the project. I want to understand what the situation is there to make sure that we're hopefully helping out some of the people in your area.
You know, I have supported that project all along, but the CEO of Kutsunuwa is here.
Good.
I'd rather have him speak to that. Thank you.
Well, that'll be perfect. I do see that there. Okay. You know, there's a few other people signed up, but since I asked the question and it's related, if you don't mind, I'd like to have you come up, do your presentation, and then you can answer the question afterwards, if that's okay. Is it Peter Navor?
My name is Peter Nowroz.
Nowroz,
yes.
Okay.
N-A-O-R-O-Z.
Okay. Thank you for spelling that. And please go ahead and restate, you know, your company and everything.
I'll do that. Mr. Chairman, I have provided each of the members of the committee a binder here.
I see that.
And I'll be making reference to that from time to time. My name is Peter Nowrose, and I'm the president and general manager of Coots Noe, Inc. And as Jody said, we are the I'm the person who's probably knows the most about the Thayer Lake project that you'd asked a question about. And in all my comments are in writing, and they're included in the booklet. Just as a prefatory matter, Coots Noe is an ANGSA corporation, and we are the ANGSA corporation for Angoon. And as part of our land settlement in the middle of a national monument wilderness, we had some hydro rights reserved in our name. So we are, therefore, we applied for the Thayer Lake monies in that capacity. We have about 1,100 shareholders throughout Southeast. There are a few in the lower 48, but we're roughly half in Angoon, half in Juneau, and then a few over. Well, a third in Angoon, a third in Juneau, and most of the other ones are in Sitka. So we have a kind of a broad Southeast perspective. Most of our assets are located in the Southeast. We have, in addition to the hydro, we have lands down in southern Prince of Wales, next to the Niblack project, so we have an interest in mining interests that are at the lower part of the region. And our perspective is certainly tempered by the fact that our ratepayers, particularly the commercial interest, pay 67 cents a kilowatt. And we have these lands that we're trying to develop in a similar environment in terms of energy costs. So we've spent a considerable amount of time looking at energy and therefore the extensive notes that we were providing you. I will try to keep my comments to 3 minutes. I could go on the rest of the day, but I won't. Now, obviously, you won't let me. But the 3 minutes should be enough to really kind of cover the high points, which are really, you know, how does the private sector work in Southeast, and how can we work with the state of Alaska to contribute to the energy solution for the region? And this plan that, that I'm going to testify today doesn't provide for that. So, and we have some suggestions, and we've been working with the AEA on that. To get back to your question, we are thankful and to the state of Alaska and the advisory working group for announce or committing Thayer as a committed project within the IRP. There was no analysis done in the IRP on the project itself. It was an advisory working group's recommendation based on previous letters of support and kind of the region's knowledge of the project. Working with the AEA has been difficult. And one of the things that we're doing is trying to come up with a guideline for how to move forward with the various grants we have. And without going into all that, we have retained counsel, and we're looking at the grant agreement. There were some prefatory matters that are no longer required by the AEA. And while we got the grant around four monies, it was based on a matching grant that we got from the Department of Energy. So we're trying to combine those two together and get a document that works seamlessly through the design and construction process. We've been in discussions with as recently as last week with the AEA on terms that are now satisfactory to us, and we'll be moving forward on that basis. It's true we don't have a signed agreement at this point, but we expect to have one very shortly, and our commitment to the project is has been for 5 years the top priority for the corporation. So thank you to the state of Alaska, to the administration for your support. The SEIRP is a radical departure from the energy planning of Southeast Alaska and its leadership's collective vision for 30 years. It raises more questions than it answers, and some of them are getting answered right now because of this committee's attention, and so for that we're thankful. It prematurely comes to conclusions that cannot be supported by facts. The fact that the intertie system is expensive is true, but there are many ways we can move forward with by cutting those costs down, and those haven't been looked at in terms of the SEIRP. One of them I'll mention right now because it's so important is that Representative or Congressman Don Young introduced a bill some years ago called Safety Lou, which provides for corridors through the Tongass, and those are shown in the map that I've provided you. Those corridors allow for a certain size of utility line to be built as a matter of right. And so we don't have to go spinning our wheels and going endlessly through a process of back and forth with the Forest Service and the NGOs. So far, we have not done our work to get that done. There are best interest determinations that the state needs to undertake to move us forward. And if we implemented smartly and used all the tools, whether they're Congressman Young's bill that was passed by the Congress or working with our tribal neighbors and citizens throughout Southeast, we could get this done. It may be close to $1 billion, but for instance, Kusnu has proposed many times a way to save about $100 million by our calculations. And so we're asking AEA to look at that. So if it's $900 million, is it still too expensive? I don't know, but I think the answers are going to be answered as part of this process. We heard testimony during the first part of this hearing that this plan was not ready for prime time. Well, that's true. But I think, as was also said, this is the best plan we have. And so what we need to do is go back to the AEA and ask the hard questions, find out where the sensitivity is around the costs, and then move forward collectively as a region. My last tab here shows a number of questions in terms of future load. And I am sort of skipping to the conclusion here, but we have sawmills that need to be built. We have mines that need to be built, some of them within 5 years. I have a map here that shows, and I'll take some exception here with some previous testimony. For instance, the Greens Creek and Kensington Mine, which are operating mines, they need to be looked at analytically as separate loads, just like Angoon is. Angoon's a half a megawatt load right now. We have an airport plan that's not in this IRP. We have new ferry terminal at the state's building that's not in the IRP. We have dedicated to our shareholders 1,000 lots. None of those lots are being absorbed during the time period that is provided here. And an all-electric home would be a really nice solution for our community, given that we have a project. Now, the question is, should that project be 1 megawatt or should it be 3 or 4 or 5? And that's one of the real costs that isn't being considered in this IRP, is that we are undersizing lines and we're undersizing loads and we're undersizing generation capability. And so I think that, a real healthy conversation back and forth with AEA, including how does the private sector participate. This analysis assumes that the state's going to pay for all the generation and all the transmission lines. I would say that if we had the transmission lines planned and it was a reliable, we could expect to move, that they would actually be built, that you'd have the private sector fill in right behind and get that generation up. So out of $2 billion, roughly, half of it would be transmission and half of it would be generation. You could find a lot of help in the private sector. Tribal monies would flow in. But that's not what this plan contemplates. It contemplates, and there's this tab in here that shows a summary because it's not in the IRP. I thought that the committee should see this. A summary under tabs between 5 and 6 that we plan to spend $222 million in the next 3 years, if this plan is adopted, on biomass, energy efficiency, DSM, and diesel plants. I don't think that's what, good planning is. I think good planning is the state says this is where the state can do the most. The federal government, you need to provide us these corridors. This is how we get power around in the region over time. And that... And let the participants, such as Kuchner, participate in this process. President Lincoln said, and this is appropriate given this is President's Week, the legitimate object of government is to do for a community or people whatever they need to have done, but cannot do at all, or cannot do well for themselves in their separate individual capacities. And all that the people can do individually, for instance, buying pellet stoves, we ought to let them do that. I mean, people know how to heat their homes. They don't know how to get 6 cent power in Angoon. So what we've put together is a plan based on Administrative Order 230 or the response to it during the Murkowski administration. that was provided to Governor Palin that said the agencies within the state need to work together on getting these interties done and looking towards the Thomas Bay projects to provide majority of the power. Angoon prepared a resolution that's followed that administrative order. And we've been working for the past 4 years to accomplish that. Before we throw that away, I think we ought to have an IRP that fairly evaluates the loads and the potential loads. These mining sectors need to be analyzed. The timber industry needs to be analyzed in this regard. The biggest factor that's missing from this plan is the cruise ship plug-ins. Now, that is a highly controversial subject, I'll tell you that. And I acknowledge that, but that's going to be more, within 50 years, every cruise ship's going to have a plug-in. And the question is our load going to be there for them to plug into? And I think this IRP completely ignores that. So what we've done is we've talked to the project manager, and he's very agreeable to running one more time, the model to see what happens if you do that. So, Mr. Chairman, that basically concludes my comments, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking at the map, and there was it showed on here that Angoon had a natural occurring energy hydro tidal. Is this an experiment, or
is through the chair, Representative Peterson, we have probably the best tidal resource in the state. It doesn't freeze up. It's right next to town. You can watch the tide come in, and we've been talking to folks about putting a torch or some sort of fixed device that would allow tidal engines to go in and out. But honestly, that's been slow in coming. And one of the issues is that Canada, for instance, is offering a feed-in tariff of about 50 cents for the tidal companies to come there. So there's really not an incentive, to go out and spend your time and resources in places like Angoon or Alaska, for that matter, when you have the Canadians saying, come here, we'll pay you to come here. So as a matter of policy, we're not ready for prime time there. So I think getting some of these policy things done as open access transmission, being more friendly to outside money, is part of our challenge here. And I think that's where this IRP could do a lot of good and help us move forward. We're 35 miles from 350 million people in terms of being connected, and that's the AKBC. And the most important thing that does, it gives us a price signal is when we should build, when we should not. So, Mr. Chairman, I could go on, as I said.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Follow-up, Representative Peterson?
I was just going to say that we have to keep an eye on some of these developing technologies, because once they become perfected and you do have a natural year-round tidal source available there, I'm not sure how much electricity could be generated there, but it might be a significant amount.
Representative Peterson, through the chair, it is a significant amount, and we're looking at it.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? I appreciate your testimony. I thank you for actually bringing up one that we have not talked about is cruise ships, so that's not something I had thought about. I appreciate you bringing that up. The next person that we have here, we're going to go back up, and looks like we have Harold Frank Jr. All right. Please put yourself on the record and state your affiliation, if you have any, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Harold Frank. I'm from Juneau. And I just recently graduated from the university with a degree in renewable energy, actually, and the question about tidal energy was actually my thesis topic. My name is Harold Frank. I've had a 20-year career in Southeast Alaska, and I've done everything from federal to private sector land management and environment planning. One of the reasons I wanted to testify is because there's been much said about Angoon, and I'm actually from there. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to provide feedback regarding the Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. I spent my formative years in Angoon and consider it my home. During this period, I remember a time when we turned off the diesel generators to save fuel and money. On a personal note, I just completed my master's program at Central Washington University with an emphasis on methods Angoon could use to provide affordable, renewable energy to residents in my village. The IRP process adopted for Southeast seems to mirror the federal process outlined in the Energy Policy Act of 1992 under the Energy Efficiency Section, which is Title I. The federal process encouraged utilities to promote energy efficiencies around existing infrastructure and not consumer behavior. You know, I think we've been ignoring that for some time. Even as early as 1992, Congress recognized that affordable energy was a crucial part of the economy and relied on energy providers to generate ways to improve energy efficiency while not increasing capacity. The same pattern is reflected in the draft SCIRP. I was not here to track the SCIRP process because I was pursuing my master's degree over the last 3 years. But after a brief review of the document, I did identify some concerns. The first concern I had was the apparent lack of inclusiveness in what should have been a transparent process, given that this is a 50-year plan. The affected consumers appear not to have a voice in the process. The apparent lack of effort to include smaller municipalities and tribes amidst valuable input from those that face the steepest energy costs. Also, potentially economic industry leaders such as the mining and tourism industry appeared to be excluded from identifying opportunities for energy demand, which could lead to economic expansion for Southeast Alaska. The second concern I have is the conclusions and recommendations arrived at in this document. The energy path in the plan promotes energy efficiency and use of biofuels as a remedy to augment existing infrastructure. Consumer behavior does not seem to support this energy path, as evidenced by consumption patterns in Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan, as recently as last January, which reported their highest energy consumption during this cold snap. The third concern I have is the use of the demand-side management, or DSM, to create a policy instrument that will last for 50 years. The whole notion of using demand-side economics in formulating a plan captures the here and now, but also hints at protectionism and monopolistic control of an evolving economic opportunity, specifically energy production here in Southeast Alaska. The more traditional economic model uses supply and demand to create a market. Use of the DSM model begs for an increased supply of energy. A tangible element of any healthy economy embraces competition between suppliers so consumers are served with the best prices for services. As you can tell, I just graduated from college. In 1865, British economist William S. Jevons analyzed coal consumption in the expanding British economy and noted that increased energy efficiency actually increased consumption. It's one of the classic paradoxes, called Jevons' paradox. You know, people will consume more if there's more energy efficiency. It's odd behavior, but the three big cities in the Southeast evolved around energy abundance and efficiency, but recent consumer behavior attacks the existing infrastructure. The energy spike created by the cold weather bears this pattern out and begs for more capacity. The federal IRP process codified in 1992 features DSM as a means to a goal of meeting energy demand. However, the Energy Act also provides a way to increase capacity by increasing supply. In Southeast, this can be done by identifying new energy sources, you know, such as the dams that have been proposed. In my opinion, this lack of supply can be satisfied by a north-south intertie featured in Administrative Order 230, which was signed by Governor Murkowski. The intertie was not subjected to a meaningful analysis in the IRP process, in my opinion. The full value of state and private landholdings and interests would be realized when affordable energy for all of Southeast is available, and the Intertie is a means to accomplish this goal. The draft SCRP was valuable in demonstrating that energy drives the economy in Southeast and is in short supply. The economy in the region would stabilize with affordable and reliable energy for all. I would hope in this day and age, Angoon could avoid shutting the power off again at night to remain solvent. One of the things that I've noticed in my studies in the last 3 years is that one of the roles of government, one of the more valuable roles of government, is to provide, to incentivize the process. And it doesn't necessarily involve money. You know, you can create opportunities, tax opportunities, ways that it can be returned without actually doing anything other than just providing a mechanism. That was observed in Washington when they started using the wind turbines. You know, there was no, each one of those wind turbines is about $3 million a piece. And what was done was the federal government created a tax break for the energy companies to build those, and now the wind turbines are littered all over the country down in Washington. Every place that has wind potential is being used, and that was just a tax incentive for utilities. But I think the message of all that I'd like to leave you with is like the famous line from that movie, build it and they will come. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? All right, thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Frank. We're going to move next to Duff Mitchell. Please put your name on the record and state your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Duff Mitchell, and I live at 3274 Pioneer Avenue here in Juneau. I serve as the business manager for Juneau Hydropower, Inc. We are a privately owned and privately financed hydropower development company developing the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project. It's a 30-megawatt capacity lake tap system that in an annual rainfall year will generate 136,000 megawatt hours annually. For the city and borough of Juneau. We are aggressively permitting, licensing, and we could be generating electricity in late 2015 or early 2016. A little bit about our project. Our Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project was identified as a federal site since 1915. And in 1929, the site was given a federal power site classification, which means that the federal land on the site is withdrawn for the primary use of hydropower purposes. We're not unique. There's over 35 other federal power classification sites in Southeast Alaska, which says that that federal land must be used for the primary purpose of developing hydropower, for its primary purpose. The U.S. Geological Service developed plans to construct the site in 1958, but the project was not built, according to their documents, for lack of a market for this large Juneau storage hydropower resource. In essence, the project has been studied for 100 years, but the market timing to build it is now. Our company believes in enhancing the full spectrum of environment. This includes the aquatics, the aesthetics, wildlife, and recreation, and our policy is not just merely to mitigate our impact. I have only limited time to speak on the Juneau market and IRP shortcomings, and I want to save some time to speak to solutions. Arguably, hydropower is the most cleanest and efficient form of tried and proven electrical generation known to man. Southeast Alaska is, in fact, the Saudi Arabia hydropower. The Southeast IRP provides a whole list of well-defined and identified private and public hydropower storage projects that would utilize lake tap hydropower technology developed primarily here in Southeast Alaska with Mr. Corbis's company is one of the first ones to do so. And this lake tap hydro is eco-friendly. But the Southeast IRP fails to prioritize any of these projects on project economics of what the delivered cost will be to our citizens. You cannot identify what project is at 4 cents a kilowatt versus one that's 40 cents a kilowatt. And I think that's very important when you rank or you look at what is the intended cost of energy. We'd heard of earlier comments with economies of scale and other things, and this all plays into it. John Q. Public and Aunt Mary care very little to know about the politics, the regulation, the risk of power developments. They would like to just plug it in, hit that easy Staples button, and it works. Hydropowered interties have been reliably generating electricity in the region for over 100 years. Amazingly, hydropowered interties are discounted as the preferred alternative in this plan. Since Juneau is my company's market, I want to point out three Juneau market-related issues to the IRP. One, Juneau ratepayers are converting oil to electric heat at an unprecedented rate, but for some reason this phenomenon was not quantified, not for Juneau and not for any of the other communities. I raise this since Juneau represents about one half of the Southeast energy market. According to ALMP's latest Regulatory Commission of Alaska filings in December of 2011, Juneau's firm rate kilowatt hours increased 5.66% in the last 12-month period, while interruptible customers like Hecla Greens Creek and other industry were cut off by 35.43%. That equates to a loss of about 25,000 megawatt hours that they were paying for diesel when they could have been buying hydropower. Now, insufficient hydropower capacity impacts our local Juneau economy. It isn't just oil conversions. You also have different water years. So I don't want to say that it's all because of, each year a hydropower doesn't put out a flat line. Some years are good, some years aren't so good. But when you don't have the hydropower capacity, it affects our local Juneau economy because it unnecessarily increases those energy costs to our private employers and industry that heavily contribute to our local tax base here. The Southeast IRP, like I said, did not include the kilowatt hour sales data for 2011 and 2010 for any of our communities. And if they did, the conversion growth rate doesn't look flat, but it goes like this. Two, the IRP did not identify, recognize, incorporate the City and Borough of Sitka's or the City and Borough of Juneau's Assembly-approved climate action plans. The 2011 CBJ Climate Action Plan calls for electrifying Juneau's mines, electrifying visiting cruise ships, and implementing energy efficiency such as the use of ground source heat pumps, which are three times the efficiency in the Juneau area than traditional electric heating. The Juneau Airport, Valley Aquatic Center, and ALP's corporate building all use ground source heat pumps and have literally saved this community hundreds of thousands of dollars in oil savings in a relatively short period of time. Furthermore, the most recent Juneau municipal election, there was a bond issue for converting the Auk Bay School to ground source heat pumps. That particular election won by the largest margin than any other election or bond issue by capturing 74% of the vote. If you win any election by 74% of the vote, you pretty much have a mandate. It is clear where my community is voting where it wants to go. The IRP, and we all have different opinions on global climate and whatnot. I'm just saying that that is one factor that hydropower helps, whether it's clean, it's low cost, but it also reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So I think the IRP failed to consider some of these local policies that could have been incorporated, or at least mentioned them, considered them, and that's one thing where you heard that it was a bottom-up approach. I would submit maybe that was a top-down approach by not listening to or reviewing the community energy and climate action plans. Third, the IRP perhaps creates a firewall against industrial development loads. You heard this earlier. And this negatively impacts the IRP analysis and also economically hurts the job creation and economic development of my region. As Senator Murkowski spoke this morning to both chambers, the high cost of energy is the Achilles heel of doing business in Alaska. At lunch today, she also spoke about hydropower and interties in Southeast Alaska as a resource development industry. The IRP is supposed to be an integrated plan, but I look at it as an insular plan, where our energy consumptive industries are served and managed separately from our hydropower development industry. For example, we've heard about the Kensington Mine. If the Kensington Mine was added to the Juneau electrical market, we are already undersupplied. They burn about 67,000 megawatt hours, give or take, you know, that's about roundabout. And if you and what business would not like to have lower costs? Of course they would. And by building things of economy of scale and building hydropower at capacity, we can do that. So I submit to you that hydropower capacity does help the residents by building larger projects which can drop down power, and we have to include the whole spectrum of users. Some non-Juneau market specific comments on the IRP. The IRP project financing models only include public financing. Hey, I'm private. You know, I'm kind of left out in the cold here, at least for a model that's considered. We're bringing in money out of our pockets and out of our investors' pockets, and we're raising money to help our community. But the models in the IRP are public grants, public money, and I do think there needs to be some consideration where private industry can help serve our state's needs and create the energy that we need. It also, I will say, is that our state energy policy does, in fact, promote private enterprise and encourage private development. We're working that end. Okay, well, the IRP also states that oil is going back to normal or lower prices in 8 different places. I don't know what you guys feel, but I think they're going up. And when you base analysis on potentially that the oil prices are going down, you skew your numbers. You're saying, oh, well, this oil conversion is going to stop or going to mitigate because, you know, in a couple years, oil is going to go back to normal. That's not what our Department of Revenue says, so why is AEA saying that? I got some cognitive dissonance there. The IRP does not identify barriers to entry. We talk about the federal overreach. We have some state problems here. I think that the IRP should have talked about or at least discussed where is the state getting in the way of stopping either public or private power developments. And this goes back to the state regulatory regime at RCA, AEA, and other agencies. Where can they go and find regulations, or where can they go out and help foster energy development for private investment and attract private investment into our The IRP also mentions but does not discuss what open access tariff reform is. And unless you're in the business, you probably don't know what it is either. But open access tariff reform says if you're a little guy, you can play on the big guy's lines. We're one of 2 states in the country that don't have that because we don't have interstate trade. And so OAT was identified, but nobody talks about the advantages and disadvantages or how maybe that would help consumers if a little guy builds a 1 megawatt thing and he wants to go on to the Swan-Tyee line. Is he going to have interconnectability or not? OATT says you do. Alaska doesn't necessarily provide that easy button on the issue. The IRP working group also did not include resource development industries, as we've heard, or independent power producers. I think many problems surfaced in the IRP probably could have been avoided if that initial table had been more inclusive. Another issue is that, and I've handed out this thing, is price volatility. That's not in there. Well, excuse me, if we're going to go to pellets or we're going to go to any fuel sources, one of the components of making that decision is what is the volatility. And so I give this to you, the fuel cost, and I got this out of New Hampshire, state of New Hampshire, and also out of pelletheat.org, which is the pellet institute that promotes pellet use. You know, fuel cost oil went up 226% in the last decade. Propane went up 209%. Pellet fuel cost growth went up 89%. And due to Mr. Corbis's fine-run company, we only went up 27% in the Juneau community. So this volatility was completely ignored. So I just want to close with a couple thoughts. Hydropower is a flat-out safe hedge against all other fuel volatilities. I also want to quote you from what the AEA said in the contract. They had a legal disclaimer in there, and right at the front of the document. It says, the granularity of the analysis underlying this IRP and the quality and inclusiveness of all available information on potential projects as discussed elsewhere is not sufficient to identify the optimal combination of specific resources that should be developed. Therefore, I don't think anyone can say that this plan is great going this way or that way because there's a disclaimer right out there out front that it's not picking the optimal. The question but then must be raised is what we spend $1 million on. I think we should have had a list or optimized what this could be. If someone is going to come here and say we got to go this way or this way based on this, they can't, because this information automatically has a disclaimer that the information isn't complete. The go-forward plan. Objectively, the IRP deserves an incomplete grade on fulfilling its intended purpose. It's skewed with predisposed and designed outcomes. You heard that these interties are very expensive. I wish someone would ask Bob Grimm when he was here last time what it cost him to run a line from Haines to Skagway, 15 miles of submarine line for $7 million. Of course, you get a better deal when you hire the private guy. Now, if you probably gold-plated that with the government way, it might have been $100 million. But what I'm saying is numbers are different depending on who you talk to. And so, you know, there's a whole spectrum of what is really real in those numbers, what is really not. Key data, therefore, I believe is incorrect and has been intentionally or unintentionally missed, and the public away from acceptable and safe conclusions. I think the legislature should consider sending this document back to AEA, forming a balanced working group that includes industry and other parties, and have an independent contractor hired, you know, to follow through with this, to come back with the final, and the bottom line is to look at all these optimal combination of resources in a common sense and balanced manner. The final IRP should be energy source agnostic. I'm not here to promote hydropower. I want it to stand on its own 2 feet, but I think it should be energy agnostic as opposed to specifically marking a special fuel source or a certain fuel source, or providing maybe risky solutions. Thank you very much for allowing Southeast Alaska Private Energy Development Company to testify you before today. It's an honor and a privilege to candidly present to you the views from the private industry, from our vantage point. And thank you very much for taking up this issue and hearing the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions from committee members? All right. Thank you for your presentation. We're going to move next to Ketchikan, Trevor Sand or Sunday. Are you there?
Yeah, Trevor Sandy.
Trevor, please, if you would, state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Today I'm representing a few different hats. One is Tongass Forest Enterprises of Ketchikan, which is Southeast Alaska's first pellet manufacturing mill. The other is R&M Engineering in Ketchikan, of which I am the president of a small engineering company that has about 20 employees. And the other is representing Marble Construction, of which I'm the owner of a small construction company. So I really don't have specific testimony. I just wanted to share my perspective as kind of a broad industry type person. Biomass became a passion of mine in 2006 when I had the opportunity to design and construct the Craig central heat plant that fires off of wood chips. It heats their swimming pool, the middle school, the elementary school, and the elementary school gym. That project went from about $250,000 a year in fuel costs down to $30,000 a year. They purchased bulk fuel chips from the Viking Lumber Mill on Prince Will, or Viking Lumber in Prince Will. That project was commissioned in 2008 and was the first one in Alaska and was largely unheard of. Recently, there are a couple schools in the Central Alaska Tok and Delta Junction are now fired with wood chips. And I'd like to point out that the IRP really doesn't mention wood chips specifically. It really just talks about pellets. But I think depending on each situation, wood chips are far less expensive and a good, you know, very good heat source for a central heat plant or larger installations. R&M, or Marble Construction rather, the construction company that I own, we were the successful bidder on converting the Kaufman Cove School to a diesel heat system to a chunk wood fired system. That was a garden in the box, fairly inexpensive and extremely efficient and fairly inexpensive to operate. Kaufman Cove hire some firewood cutters, and they've been extremely happy with it. So biomass is going to come in a lot of different forms, depending on, you know, the region. Villages might profit more from smaller chunk wood systems rather than pellet systems. But as a person that's passionate in that industry, I felt that it was going to grow because the economics of it are just tremendous. And so I invested in constructing a pellet mill here in Ketchikan, and we started producing our first pellets about 2 weeks ago. We have contracts with the Ketchikan Discovery Center to supply pellets. I believe that our delivered price for pellets is about $305. And our contract, you know, when we got the contract, we couldn't produce a pellet, so we were pricing basically that service by purchasing pellets from Oregon, transferring them to Seattle, and then shipping them up. So there's been a $375 number that was kicked around, and that seems a little bit high based on what we are currently able to deliver pellets for. The other thing is I firmly believe that wood is going to be extremely stable. We've got a half a dozen sources that are massive volumes of biomass that don't really even include cutting timber right now, specifically for biomass production. And I believe that as this industry grows, some of the mills on Thorn Bay are attempting to get a pellet mill produced. Somebody like Viking Lumber is going to jump into the game. And I think that the cost of pellets and biomass in general is just going to go down and probably stabilize in the mid-200s, similar to that report. So our target and our business model is to grow as Ketchikan grows and our, you know, really a nice, profitable sales price for pellets is about $250. My company, R&M Engineering, we spent 12 years surveying on the intertie. It was a huge blessing for our company. I'm intimate with all 57 miles between Wrangell and Ketchikan. But the cost of that intertie really hasn't benefited Ketchikan like we all had hoped it would be. And I agree with the IRP in that regard. I think that biomass really makes sense. It's for all of Southeast, especially when you get off of the Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan hydro grids. But even in those areas, I believe that it's going to be necessary because so many people are going to jump ship from diesel to electric as diesel costs rise. So electric's going to have to raise prices just to stem that supply and demand. And biomass really would be a nice alternative if people could jump from diesel to biomass, you know, if it was a stable market and a stable supply. That's really all I had. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
All right. Thank you. Trevor, Representative Lynn has a question for you.
Right. Can you use any kind of wood to make these pellets?
So far, all of the test batches that we've sent off that include spruce, hemlock, and cedar have all passed the premium pellet grade in terms of BTUs and bulk densities. We have a little too many fines, so being only a week or two old in our producing scheme, we need to get some screens so some of the fine dust falls out. But our indication is that we can make it out of any species. And one of the things is my engineering company is currently processing a landfill for a mill owner on Prince of Wales through ADEC. And the intention is to landfill 170,000 yards of wood waste that really isn't quite pulp chip grade quality, but certainly perfectly good to run through a pellet mill. And I think if you look around, that's going to happen in countless situations if mills continue to operate even on the small scale that we have in Southeast right now.
I assume you have it down in Southeast, but we have no shortage of spruce bark beetle kill trees. could something like that be used?
So I think the TOC example is they have a school that's run by wood chips, and the school district actually just purchased a tub grinder, and they're harvesting and grinding trees. They're not even outsourcing that. They're doing it in-house. So, and it's going into forests just like that.
Well, thank you very much. I've just, you know, we have all these spruce bark beetle kill trees. It'd be nice to lower the risk of fire and at the same time do something with them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Lynn. Thank you, Trevor, for your testimony. It is quarter till. We do want to make sure that we run through everyone here. There are five individuals. If you would please just make sure that you're cognizant of those other people. We do want to make sure that the members that have meetings at 5 o'clock can make those meetings. We're going to move next to the Petersburg LAO. We have Joe Sebastian. Joe, if you would please put your name on the record, affiliation if you have it, and please try to keep it to 3 minutes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Sebastian. I'm a commercial fisherman representing myself. And these comments on the draft Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. Following this proposal, as it's winded its way along, too often a big proposal project like this massive conversion to pellet heat in Southeast Alaska and elsewhere becomes a gold rush to capture the government subsidies rather than find a modern, far-sighted solution to energy costs in our future. Having lived off the grid in Point Baker for 25 years and Cooper Knoll for 8 years with generator, propane lights, battery-powered lights, inverter, and solar panels, I want to say there are other options that I'm not really seeing addressed here because I've gotten along quite well with these alternative solutions. And I also know, and I haven't heard anyone mention it, not Mr. Peter Narros or Harold Frank Jr., who both are from Angoon, that recently, in the last year or so, Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, working with the elders in Angoon, reconditioned a house with solar panels, inverter, and battery, and totally insulated the thing. And I'm not sure what kind of heat, a small toyo or just how, but the project was considered a huge success and drastically lowered energy costs for that particular family. But I've not heard, it's not mentioned in the plan, it's not mentioned by either of these individuals. And I think for some of these areas outside the off the grid, there's just other things that need to be considered that aren't big policy issues like we've been hearing so much about today. Well, one of the other things I'd like to speak to is the pellet industry in Southeast Alaska. And it was interesting to hear Mr. Sandy and his work, and I assume when he's talking about $300 a ton and $250, he's talking about a ton of pellets. My own personal experience, when I look at what's available Southeast Alaska for shipping and labor costs, I think it's going to be difficult for a pellet industry to compete on a wide scale outside of its own local town. I'm sure Mr. Sandy can supply pellets for Ketchikan, but when you look at a place like British Columbia with 29 million acres of beetle-killed trees, a rail system that rolls into Prince Rupert, a modern shipping port, it's going to be really difficult to compete with someone who can get that kind of material, pellets or chips, to the consumers in such an efficient and cheap manner. And like I said, I don't see that being addressed in this plan. It's just we're going to convert as many stoves to pellet as we can and hope somehow the technology catches up with us. And I think this is rather flawed, bonanza-type thinking. If the Sea Alaska Corporation actually milled any of its wood supply instead of exporting it all overseas in the round, there possibly could be a waste stream of excess material to make pellets with. However, without heavy government subsidies, a major pellet-producing industry in Southeast Alaska will probably never get off the ground, and if it does, when the subsidies are pulled, it's probably also going to collapse. The idea of putting the Tongass in the old growth into a pellet farm, much like it used to be a pulp farm, is never going to get anywhere. And the on-the-ground cost of production and in the field and shipping is going to make the pellet-only industry cost prohibitive. There are other options out there, and I think there's a lot of material on these alternative forms of energy, and people have been studying it a long time. I've heard a lot of other people like Mr. Edwards and the heat pumps. I think a lot more work needs to be done on this draft plan before it's finally delivered to the public. Thank you very much for your time, sirs.
Thank you, Mr. Sebastian. We'll move to David Beebe in Petersburg. Please state your name as well as any affiliation. And please, please, please try to keep it to the 3 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Beebe. I'm a commercial fisherman, and I'm representing only myself with these comments on the draft Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. I've been following energy issues in Southeast for several years, both at the Tongass Futures Roundtable and in other venues. My interest as a commercial fisherman is in the fact that effects of climate change and ocean acidification will have profound effects, not just on my livelihood, but on the economy of the region, the rest of the state, and well beyond. Over time, we risk exceeding critical threshold limits, which will trigger climatic feedback responses. We have been warned by the world's leading scientists on this subject that the risk is, quote, irreversible, catastrophic climate change, close quote. Alaska is already among the first to experience firsthand the magnitude and severity of climate change problems brought on by man-made carbon emissions. As a matter of fact, they've already arrived ahead of schedule. But climate change is everyone's problem, and Southeast Alaska possesses world-class solutions to help solve it. Several federal-level energy studies have concluded this, and it has been said, of course, that Southeast is a veritable Saudi Arabia of renewable energy resources, which have no carbon emissions. Our tidal, wind, geothermal, and wave energy sources constitute applied solutions which could well make us the envy of the world. It was my expectation that this IRP as a 50-year plan would be actually providing energy solutions which will help to stem the climate crisis we're facing well within that time frame. This is not the case. Black & Veatch, the Forest Service, and curiously the Coast Guard are all on record claiming biomass energy is carbon neutral. This mystifies me, given the massive amount of scientific research recently showing biomass is anything but carbon neutral. Our rainforests in Southeast, because they are rainforests, lack the catastrophic events normally associated with forests, and as a consequence, store some of the highest volumes of carbon per acre of all North American forests. The carbon losses of a region-wide conversion to biomass will accelerate climate change. Management activities necessary to effect a region-wide conversion to biomass heating will have negative consequences with significant opportunity costs. These opportunity costs are associated with a missed opportunity to position Southeast as an exporter of storable carbon-free energy such as hydrogen production. I cannot support the February 8th references to opening up the region to private development. In conclusion, the Integrated Resource Plan has merits in focusing on DSM and energy efficiency, but it's foregone conclusions of an aggressive region-wide conversion to biomass space heating are highly suspect. A region-wide conversion to biomass will rely heavily upon federal subsidies, which mirror the historic subsidies and ultimately fails to pass the sustainability test once these subsidies are no longer available. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beebe. Any questions? Seeing none, appreciate that. We'll move to offline. We have Paul Southland with the ACE Coalition, ACE Coalition. Please state your name as well as your affiliation and try to keep it to 3 minutes, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try my best. My name is Paul Southland. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Canada Energy Coalition. I've served in the capacity of mayor and a council member of Wrangell. Currently, I'm the interim general manager of Thomas Bay Power Authority. My comments are as the executive director of the ACE Coalition. We're made up of a group of businesses, individuals, tribal entities, and communities in both Alaska and Canada. I don't need to explain that my community of Wrangell has traded with British Columbia through the Stikine River and Bradfield Canal Trail for centuries. The ACE Coalition was formed to promote a connection to the North American grid for the express purpose of providing a mechanism to build a backbone to catalyze the development of our renewable energy resources in Southeast. Ms. Fisher Goad testified at the last hearing that I was a member of the citizen work group of the SDIRP. When the RFP for the IRP in Section 5.1 called for a component on, quote, planning for economic development, end quote, my board consented to my participation in the process. Like Mr. Graham, I find the Southeast IRP gravely flawed in that it specifically failed to deliver what it advertised. At the previous hearing, Representative Sadler asked Kevin Harper of Black & Veatch, the contractor, to explain the key findings as if to his grandmother. This is my version of what the report says in a nutshell. Do the projects you plan, but no more. Conserve all you can. Forget about industry or economic development, burn pellets, and in a couple of years hire us for another $1 million or so to tell you what to do next. Contrary to the AEA testimony of Jim Strandberg that this process was bottom-up driven, it was in fact an AEA and a select few top-down approach to planning. From the very first work group meeting, it was clear that biomass would be a significant component even before the contract work had begun. Not necessarily a bad thing, but it clearly indicates a study bias when the AEA biomass coordinator was a scheduled attendee at all the meetings. We clearly face an energy crisis situation in many of our communities, and supplying reasonable cost energy for home heating, transportation, and economic stimulus. This draft report contains assumptions focused only on the home heating component and then minimizes the impact of heating oil pricing. The RFP does not describe why consumers wisely have substituted from oil to electric heat, but focuses on altering consumer behavior with demand-side management and biomass as opposed to market forces and market principles. Simply put, who is listening to the consumer's clear choice of hydroelectricity to heat their homes where it is available? On oil, does anyone really think that oil prices are going anywhere but up? Yet the draft Southeast IRP states that oil pricing will return to a lower or more normal level, not once but on 8 different places in the draft. This perhaps ludicrous lower price oil scenario is used to soften the dire emergency situation that my region is in. It further masks the serious trouble that we will be facing as oil continues to rise and even more people switch to hydropower. Interestingly, Black & Veatch stating and even publishing on the internet that oil prices will increase and continue to increase for other clients. Somebody smarter than me needs to ask, why is AEA and the Southeast IRP predicting lower oil prices? In November, at a work group meeting in the Sea Alaska Plaza, the contractor had their transmission line specialist on a teleconference line explaining a PowerPoint presentation showing their concept of the Southeast Intertide Plan. The gentleman could not pronounce geographical names, was absent of distance relationship between communities, and generally could not answer any questions from the working group. Interestingly, this plan was heavily weighted towards submarine cables spanning north to south throughout the region. When asked why submarine cables were chosen, the answer was most reliable, least cost. Shortly after this presentation, a meeting was held in Seattle by a select few utility members of the work group, and transmission connections and large hydropower storage projects were dropped from the discussion. I wonder why. The Swan Tie Intertie has been in operation as one of the first segments of the proposed Southeast Intertie, as referenced in the Southeast Conference Resolution Number 611, signed by President Venables. I can find only resounding praise for the economics of this intertie. Did the contractor use the actual wheeling cost of this segment when they screened the rest of the intertie plan? Did the contractor use the wheeling cost from the Haines to Skagway line or the Juneau to Greens Creek line that is reported to be significantly below a fraction of a cent? No, I don't believe they did. As a matter of fact, when Myron Rollins, lead for the project, was asked in Juneau what the confidence interval was for the AKBC intertie screening data, he answered plus or minus 30%. The AKBC is arguably within 10% of being cost effective, even with flawed assumptions and only screening for import or export, rather than a much more likely scenario of a combined import-export operation. If the data is adjusted for the minus 30% possibility, then it becomes a proverbial no-brainer. Yet it was dismissed out of hand. I cannot figure out logically why. Gentlemen, I understand that we're running out of time here, and my testimony will go on. I provided it in written form, but I want to conclude with this very personal note. As I listened to the mayor of Angoon testify to this committee, it brought tears to my eyes. He, along with 20+% of his constituents in Angoon, are heroes of this nation. Albert walked the sands of Iraq for this country. He is facing a dire energy crisis. He and his community have worked within the rules of engagement to acquire the development rights for a hydropower project and to collaborate with private investors on another. Yet at every turn, he has been thwarted by real power, which does nothing for his community or the region as a whole. Please bring this type of discriminatory behavior to an end. Support all the work toward the development of the region's resources and insist on a level playing field. The IRP can be fixed, but it must be fixed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Southland. The only person that I have left here is actually, looks like, Stan Selmer and Mavis Hendrickson from Skagway, Municipality of Skagway. Would you like to...
Mr. Chairman, we are here. We'll be as brief as we can.
Oh, please.
What was that?
Please, and go ahead and continue.
Yes, my name is Stan Selmer. My testimony today is as the mayor of Skagway. Skagway will file their comments timely with CERP with another date. I just want to have one item brought before the committee's attention, and that is Skagway, in my opinion, has been already harmed by the CERP plan. We have, for the last number of years, tried to get renewable energy funding for a 25-megawatt hydro project adjacent to Skagway called West Creek. The West Creek project's primary purpose was to offset diesel generation by cruise ships that dock in Skagway from May to September. Secondary purpose was to provide power to the local grid during periods of shortfall and to the Yukon Territory grid in the wintertime. We were unsuccessful the first couple times in applying for the funding. However, this time, when we applied for feasibility and conceptual design monies of $238,000, we were denied on the basis of a flawed document that was not even in the hands of the working group yet, and the CERP was utilized to deny our funding because the CERP reference load forecasts did not include cruise ship loads. In addition, in the CERP reference cases, the least cost course of action in Upper Lynn Canal does not include adding any hydro capacity until 2050. We filed an appeal, and just before we sent the appeal to the AEA, they withdrew their findings that were based on the CERP document because it was not a public document yet. Well, unfortunately for Skagway, the damage was already done. We were successful with our appeal, but we were only successful after other projects had already been awarded funding. So now we're at the lower end of the second list of projects that have been approved for funding, for which there is no funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. It does look like there was one other person that has signed up.
My name is Mavis Irene Henriksen, and I have worked hard to see the inner tie. I went to Governor Palin with a way of paying for some of it, and it didn't happen. I'll send my whole statement to you by email. Bye.
Well, thank you, Mavis. I appreciate that, and if you send it to it, we'll make sure that all of the committee members have it, and I appreciate your input there. The only person I have, looks like someone has come since the Benedict Donald. Is it
Burford.
As we are a little over the time, if you wouldn't mind, just as quick as possible.
It will be. Yeah. It will be. But I'd like to start out with a very short story. Basically, born and raised Juneau, educated here, graduated University of Alaska, worked the trades through the state of Alaska, but basically down southeastern. 1962, we're on Prince Wales Island, we're building road. My grandmother at that time, who is 80 years old, is standing up, looking out, and she's seeing a ferry go up. And her comment, and they were in at that time the saltery business, and she says, "My land, if anybody would have ever told me that we would have scheduled boats running up and down the bay, I just wouldn't believe it." Point being, it's a period of time. The period of time is water. We have water. We have water where we have nothing else. The time is to utilize that water. The report that I read and what the information I get out of it is I don't think we're paying enough attention to access. By that, we have to have the access. We've got to get the government off of our backs on this. If you don't have this, none of this works. To say that British Columbia is not interested in the intertie just is not true. Fact does not back this out. If First Nations are working on this very diligently, and certainly BC Hydro is building the last major dam that they can on the waterworks that goes all the way down into the state of Washington, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If we can't have access, none of this is going to work. And there are various ways. This biomass might work. I don't have a lot of faith because, again, we don't have access. In southeastern Alaska, we still are basically owned by the federal government. And just try to get anything by the federal government unless it's something they want. That basically is my plea. Don't walk away from this. Ask the right questions. I'm a little bit suspect of this report, that not the engineering. I think the engineering is very factual, you know, one and one still two and all that. But the reality of it is, I think that the thrust of it is a little bit suspect from my point of view, in the sense that many of the people who are on the board and whatnot of this nature are very familiar with their part of the world. They really are not familiar with this part of the world. They have a game plan that they're following, and we're just sort of the appendix on the appendix that you cut off when you don't need. And if what I'm getting from this that I understand, in essence, lip service is being paid to southeastern Alaska, but there is nothing that is coming forward that's going to happen unless we get the access, we hold on to the water, and go from there. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Don. Well, it is about 5:08, and I want to thank everyone for not only being here, but calling in, everyone who took their time out, we were able today to give a little bit more leniency to people to kind of speak. I think we got a little bit of kind of their heartfelt feelings on this, so I appreciate the opportunity for people. I appreciate everyone coming out and taking this opportunity. We will, anyone that does have testimony that was in writing, but we will make sure it gets passed on to AEA, or if you choose to do it on your own, and I know some people are still formulating that, we come and see my staff, Dirk Kraft, afterwards. We have information here. I won't just say it right now. But we'll go ahead and adjourn it. It is 5:09, and the next meeting, well, you'll get notice of the next meeting.